If you ever get the chance to go to Edinburgh, you'll probably visit downtown by train, and you'll probably get off at Waverley Station, the city's principal train station, named after the series of Scottish novels. From there, you'll want to check out Princes Street Gardens, a public park about a block away. Walking from the train station to the park, you'll probably walk up Waverley Steps, through the Waverley Mall, and past the old Waverley Hotel. Once in the park, you'll encounter an ornate Gothic spire dedicated to the man who wrote those Waverley novels. This is the Walter Scott Monument. Commissioned shortly after Scott's death in 1832 and completed in 1844, the Scott Monument stands at over 200 feet tall, making it the largest monument to a writer in the world. The monument is adorned with 68 statues, depicting other major writers of Scott's day, like James Hogg and Lord Byron, major British historical figures like Queen Elizabeth and Oliver Cromwell, and major figures from Scott's works, like Rob Roy MacGregor and Friar Tuck. Scott himself is depicted in the center of the tower, seated with a book in his hands and his dog at his side. You can walk up the 288 steps of one of the spire's spiral staircases to reach a viewing platform where you get a 360-degree view of the city. It's quite a beautiful sight. I can't think of another city that holds its most famed writer in such high esteem. Dublin's relationship with James Joyce comes close, but I would bet a bottle of Lagavulin against a bottle of Jameson that, upon final tally, the Scotsman's local reputation would have the Irishman's beat. I think that's because Scott wasn't just one great Scottish writer. He was three. This is Frankenstein's Afterlife. With apologies to Ira Glass, I'd like to present the life of Sir Walter Scott in three acts. Act 1, The Poet. Walter Scott was born in Edinburgh on August 15, 1771. Though he attended literary salons and befriended several prominent poets, Scott didn't take to writing as a teenager the way that Mary and Percy Shelley both did. Instead, he attended the University of Edinburgh to study law and spent his early 20s as a lawyer. But starting in 1792, Scott began taking yearly trips to the Scottish border. He came to consider the borders to be his adopted home, and on these annual trips, he would collect traditional ballads from the region. Instead of faithfully capturing the originals, however, he freely adapted them, changing words, inserting new stanzas, blending different versions, and setting old legends to his own verses. In 1802, he published his collection of ballads under the title Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border. It wasn't his first publication, but it was his first to gain him any notoriety. The volume collects historical ballads, love ballads, and folk ballads, like The Lochmaben Harper, about a blind harp player planning to steal the king's horse, which begins,
"Oh, heard you na the silly blind harper, how long he lived in Lochmaben town, and how he would gang to fair England to steal the Lord Warden's wanton brown."
Scott published three volumes of Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border, but one of the ballads that Scott had collected proved too long for inclusion in the collection, and so he published it on its own in 1805 as The Lay of the Last Minstrel. Based on real historical events, The Lay of the Last Minstrel tells the tale of star-crossed lovers on the border. The Lady Margaret Scott of Bucklew is beloved by Baron Henry of Cranston, an ally of the Kerr clan, but a deadly feud exists between Clan Scott and Clan Kerr, which has recently resulted in the murder of Walter Scott of Bucklew, who was Lady Margaret's father and the author's real-life great-grandfather. Here, however, the poem diverges from history and into Gothic fantasy. Planning to use sorcery to prevent her daughter's marriage, Lady Margaret's mother, the Lady Branksome, sends one of her attendants to recover a magic book from a sorcerer's tomb. But on his way home, the attendant encounters and fights with Cranston. Wounded in the fight, the attendant is robbed by a goblin who serves as Cranston's page.
As the corslet off he took, the dwarf espied the mighty book. Much he marvelled, a knight of pride, like a book-bosomed priest should ride. He thought not to search or staunch the wound until the secret he had found. The iron band, iron clasp, it resisted long in the elfin grasp, for when the first he had undone, it closed as he the next begun. Those iron clasps, that iron band, would not yield to unchristened hand, till he smeared the cover o'er with a borderer's curdled gore. A moment then the volume spread, and one short spell therein he read. It had much of glamour might, could make a laddie seem a knight. The cobwebs on a dungeon wall seemed tapestry and lordly hall. A nutshell seemed a gilded barge, a shilling seemed a palace large. And youth seemed age, and age seemed youth. All was delusion, naught was truth.
Looking for mischief, the goblin uses the book to lure Lady Margaret's infant brother into the woods. The child is then abducted by some of the Scott clan's English enemies. Cranston uses his magic to defeat the English and return the child to Lady Branksome. Lady Branksome is so thankful that she consents to the marriage between her daughter and Cranston. The poem was a massive success and made Scott a famous poet on the same level as Wordsworth or Coleridge. The Edinburgh Review described it as in the very first rank of poetical excellence, and the Critical Review praised the skill with which Scott had refined the rich but unpolished ore of ballad poetry. Scott's last major narrative poem, The Lady of the Lake, was published in 1810. It tells the long and sprawling story of the conflict between King James V and the powerful Clan Douglas. The poem sold 25,000 copies in 8 months, breaking all records for poetry sales. Translations also proved to be hugely successful in Europe, with the German edition inspiring Schubert to compose 7 songs, one of which you're probably familiar with.
Ave Maria, maiden mild, listen to a maiden's prayer. Thou canst hear, thou, from the wild, thou canst save amid despair. Safe may we sleep beneath thy care, thou banished outcast and reviled. Maiden, hear a maiden's prayer. Mother, hear a suppliant child. Ave Maria.
That's right, folks. The original lyrics to Schubert's Ave Maria come from the German translation of Scott's poem. The poem had a massive impact on American culture as well. We hear that impact whenever the U.S. president enters a room.
Hail to the chief who in triumph advances, honored and blessed be the evergreen pine. Long may the tree in his banner that glances flourish the shelter and grace of our line.
We see Walter Scott in our icons of hate as well as our icons of liberation. Thomas Dixon was inspired by a scene in The Lady of the Lake when he described the old Scottish rite of burning the cross in his 1905 novel, The Clansmen. The Ku Klux Klan has used the burning cross as their symbol ever since. And when an escaped slave asked his friend to help him choose a new last name, the friend's reading of Lady of the Lake led him to select the name of the poem's Scottish clan. And so, the slave Frederick Bailey became the free man Frederick Douglass. Act 2, The Novelist. In 1803, Scott was offered the position of poet laureate. He turned it down, saying that the position would be a poisoned chalice because the title had fallen into disrepute. But it's also worth noting that, although poetry had made Scott an international celebrity, by 1813, the poetic phase of his career was coming to an end. As fascinated by Scottish history as he was by Scottish folk ballads, Scott had been working on a novel based on the Jacobite uprising of 1745 since at least 1808. The novel was titled Waverley and featured a young Edward Waverley becoming increasingly involved in the plans of Clan MacIver to restore Charles Stuart to the throne. He even meets Bonnie Prince Charlie himself.
A young man wearing his own fair hair, distinguished by the dignity of his mien and the noble expression of his well-formed and regular features, advanced out of a circle of military gentlemen and Highland chiefs by whom he was surrounded. In his easy and graceful manners, Waverley afterwards thought he could have discovered his high birth and rank, although the star on his breast and the embroidered garter at his knee had not appeared as its indications. "Let me present to your Royal Highness," said Fergus, bowing profoundly. "The descendant of one of the most ancient and loyal families in England," said the young chevalier, interrupting him. "I beg your pardon for interrupting you, my dear MacIver, but no master of ceremonies is necessary to present a Waverley to a Stuart." Thus saying, he extended his hand to Edward with the utmost courtesy.
Waverley goes on to fight for Charles in the losing battle of Prestonpans, before ultimately embracing the modern Scotland that has emerged thanks to English unification. But this moment, in which the fictional Edward Waverley meets the real Charles Stuart, represents something new in literature. Waverley, which was subtitled 'Tis 60 Years Since, is often called the first modern historical novel. The 20th century literary critic George Lukács argued that, in showing fictional people's interactions with known historical figures and their participation in real historical events, Scott's novel represents a new historical consciousness that emerged after the French Revolution, in which everyday people had become newly aware of their embeddedness in larger historical forces. In representing this historical consciousness, Scott had a hit on his hands. The novel's initial print run of 1,000 copies sold out in just 2 days. Over the next 5 years, Scott wrote 8 more novels centered on Scottish historical events in the 17th or 18th centuries. All of them were massive critical and commercial successes. But none of them carried Walter Scott's name. Initially concerned with his reputation as a poet, Scott released Waverley anonymously. After the novel's success, Scott decided to maintain the mystery, publishing most of his subsequent novels as By the Author of Waverley, and some under the nom de plume Jedediah Cleishbotham. He didn't actually claim authorship of his novels until 1827. Though many people were fairly certain that he was the author of the Waverley novels long before that, Mary Shelley certainly understood the impulse to publish a debut novel anonymously, but whereas Scott's anonymity generated mystery, Mary's mostly generated misattribution, with many reviewers, including Walter Scott, assuming that Percy Shelley was the author of Frankenstein. After Scott's positive review of the novel, she wrote him a letter to claim credit as the writer.
"Mr. Shelley, soon after its publication, took the liberty of sending you a copy, but, as both he and I thought, in a manner which would prevent you from supposing that he was the author. We were surprised, therefore, to see him mentioned in the notice as the probable author. I'm anxious to prevent your continuing in the mistake of supposing Mr. Shelley guilty of a juvenile attempt of mine, to which, from its being written at an early age, I abstain from putting my name, and from respect to those persons from whom I bear it. I have therefore kept it concealed, except from a few friends."
I have no doubt that Mary would have liked to count the best-selling author among her friends, but as far as I can tell, Scott never wrote her back. Act 3, The Chivalric Romancer. Scott's first 8 novels were limited primarily to Scottish locales and to relatively recent historical events. None took place more than 170 years in the past. But in 1819, Scott reinvented himself once again with Ivanhoe. Ivanhoe is set in England, not Scotland, in 1194, a little over a century after the Norman invasion. In some respects, the novel follows the formula established in Scott's earlier works, with fictional characters finding themselves embedded in real historical conflicts alongside real historical figures. In this case, the conflict between the Normans and the Saxons in 12th century England takes the place of the conflict between the Jacobites and the Hanoverians in 18th century Scotland. But while the previous Waverley novels were fairly committed to historical rigor, Ivanhoe embraces fanciful romance and swashbuckling adventure. The novel centers on Wilfred of Ivanhoe, a knight loyal to King Richard the Lionhearted, who has been away on the Crusades. Much of the novel depicts a tournament at Ashby de la Zouche Castle, where Ivanhoe competes alongside other characters, including the Black Knight and Robin of Locksley. Yep, this novel co-stars Robin Hood. In the novel, Scott gives us his version of the famous archery competition scene, where, after a little trash-talking between Locksley, Prince John, and a knight named Hubert, Locksley runs off to retrieve a stick.
Locksley returned almost instantly with a willow wand about 6 feet in length, perfectly straight and rather thicker than a man's thumb. He began to peel this with great composure, observing at the same time that to ask a good woodsman to shoot at a target so broad as had hitherto been used was to put shame upon his skill. "For his own part," he said, "and in the land where he was bred, men would as soon take for their mark King Arthur's round table, which held 60 knights around it. A child of 7 years old," he said, "might hit yonder target with a headless shaft, but," added he, walking deliberately to the other end of the lists, and sticking the willow wand upright in the ground, "he that hits that rod at 50 yards, I call him an archer fit to bear both bow and quiver before a king, and it were the stout King Richard himself." "My grandsire," said Hubert, "drew a good bow at the Battle of Hastings, and never shot at such a mark in his life, and neither will I. If this yeoman can cleave that rod, I give him the bucklers, or rather, I yield to the devil that is in his jerkin, and not to any human skill. A man can do but his best, and I will not shoot where I am sure to miss. I might as well shoot at the edge of our parson's whittle, or at a wheat straw, or at a sunbeam, as at a twinkling white streak which I can hardly see." "Cowardly dog," said Prince John. "Sir Locksley, do thou shoot, but if thou hittest such a mark, I will say thou art the first man ever did so. However it be, thou shalt not crow over us with a mere show of superior skill." "I will do my best, as Hubert says," answered Locksley. "No man can do more." So saying, he again bent his bow, but on the present occasion looked with attention to his weapon and changed the string, which he thought was no longer truly round, having been a little frayed by the two former shots. He then took his aim with some deliberation, and the multitude awaited the event in breathless silence. The archer vindicated their opinion of his skill. His arrow split the willow rod against which it was aimed. A jubilee of acclamations followed, and even Prince John, in admiration of Locksley's skill, lost for an instant his dislike to his person.
So Ivanhoe, the Black Knight, and Locksley get into a few adventures that conclude with the Black Knight revealing that he is really King Richard returned from the Crusades. Ivanhoe marries his beloved Rowena, and everyone lives happily ever after. It's a fun novel and deserves a large share of the credit for popularizing the romanticized view of medieval England that stretches through countless modern retellings of Robin Hood and Arthurian legends, and even the high fantasy of J.R.R. Tolkien and George R.R. Martin. Scott would spend the last decade of his life writing a mix of Waverley-style historical novels and Ivanhoe-style chivalric romances. He died of typhus in September 1832. It's telling that Scott's invention of the historical novel and Shelley's invention of science fiction happened within a couple of years of each other. George Lukács was right. Some sort of new consciousness was emerging in England in the early decades of the 19th century. The historical novel looks backward, and science fiction looks forward. But both wrestle with how individuals are embedded in history, a part of both natural and societal forces that are much larger than them. Funny enough, Scott himself was actually a political conservative, but his writing was revolutionary. This podcast was written, narrated, and produced by Brian Motzke at the University of Michigan. Ivanhoe was read by Stephen Nelson. Andrew Ramsey provided the voice of Sir Walter Scott. For your video content needs, you can find Andrew at 5by12films.com. That's the number 5, B-Y, the number 12, F-I-L-M-S.com. Enter the code Frankenstein for 18% off. And, once again, Mary Shelley was voiced by Mary Shelley. So, writers of the time were giving us new perspectives on history and on science. But you know what's really revolutionary? Providing sympathy for the devil. That'll be the next episode of Frankenstein's Afterlife.